Welcome everyone to this Weber training teleclass. I'd like to give a very warm welcome to our speaker today, who is Professor Judith Tanner. Judith is Chair of the Clinical Nursing Research at De Montfort University in Leicester, UK. So without any further ado, I'll hand over to Judith for what I'm sure is going to be a very interesting session on surgical site infection surveillance, advancing the prevention agenda. Judith.
Hello. Thank you very much, Vanessa. Now, I hope everyone can all hear me. I was very excited when I was approached and asked if I would speak about surveillance and ultimately what my ideal surveillance program would be, which is quite an exciting topic, and I get to say what I think. So I'm really quite excited about that. So if we switch to the first slide, and that'll just give us a quick run-through for what I'm going to talk about in this session. So if we kick off with the importance of rigorous surgical site surveillance, and then some of the limitations of our current program, and then my favourite topic, what my ideal surveillance program would be, and then ultimately, well, why should we bother? What's the purpose of doing rigorous surveillance? So on to the next slide. Well, so why do we need rigorous surveillance? Well, the main reason is really to identify the scale of the problem. How big is surgical site infection? How many patients have got SSIs? And the last thing we want to do is to underestimate the rate of SSIs, because I think that's almost worse than having no data at all. And the reason for that is that if SS rates are erroneously low, then it's lulls people into a false sense of security, and they think that they're doing okay, that their clinical practice is fine, when actually it's not. Now, let me give you an example. It's said that around 10% of patients develop hospital-acquired infections. Now, if you go on to the next slide, this is the findings of the 2006 prevalence survey for HCAIs carried out in England. And if you have a look here, you can see that surgical site infections are fourth on the list, okay? It's been underestimated. That's a low figure. And because we've come down fourth on the list of HCAIs, SSIs are not deemed as being important, and they get low priority. And if it's low priority, it's not a big deal, it's not a big issue, then it becomes very difficult for you as clinicians if you want to persuade budget holders to give you funding to pay for things if they don't perceive it to be a big problem. So, for example, if you think your patients are cold and you ask if you can have, you know, pre-op warming gowns, those lovely things that they wear before they come to the operating theatre, they're £15 each. If you go to your budget holder and say, our patients are cold, to prevent SSIs, I want to buy, you know, £15 for every patient for these warming gowns, your manager is going to say, you know, SSI rates are around 5%. It's not a big problem. I'm not going to spend that amount of money just to save a small number to prevent a small number of infections. Similarly, if you have if you want to change your gloves after we currently don't do this. If you want to change your gloves after you've prepped the patient and before starting the rest of the surgical procedure, the gloves are £2 a pop and then if it's for the whole surgical team. Again, if you say to your manager, we want to have more gloves, and she's going to say it's not important. SSI rates aren't that high. And I'm sure, certainly if you work in the UK, you will have all experienced cuts if you're working in the NHS. We're having to cut back on financial resources. And it's very difficult to argue your point and say, we want to keep this. We need the best quality gloves. We need the best quality things because we can prevent SSIs if all the data says that SSIs aren't that much of a problem. So we started talking about money, and money is very important. So if we go back to our list and we look at the next slide, the cost of underestimating the cost of SSIs. If we underestimate the rate of surgical site infections, then it follows that we underestimate the total cost of surgical site infections. And poor surveillance doesn't just underestimate the total cost, it also underestimates the individual cost of every individual infection. Now, there's little work has been done on the costing of infections. The problem is a lot of it comes out from different countries. The American papers, because their healthcare system is so different from the UK, we can't transfer the data across. So there's little work being done worldwide. But orthopaedic joint replacements are said to cost between, you know, 30 and 60,000, colorectal surgery around 10,000-15,000, breast surgery around £2,000 to treat infections in those areas. But the problem with some of those costings is that they miss out the post-discharge costs. And at, in my hospital a couple of years ago, we did a pilot study and we looked at the costing of some of our infections for colorectal surgery and for breast surgery. And we found that the biggest cost, similar to all the other studies that have looked at costing, the biggest cost was our length of stay, additional length of stay for treating the infection. But for us, because we did post-discharge follow-up, we found that our second biggest cost was on primary care staff, so it was district nurses, practice nurses, who were treating surgical site infections in the community. So some of our costings are underestimated because we're not doing the post-discharge follow-up rigorously to find out what resources are being utilised there. What we're also missing out is the cost to the economy and to the, for patients being off sick, and also the cost to the patient themselves. We're currently doing interviews with patients who've been discharged, you know, several months ago, having had a surgical site infection. And so far, we've interviewed 13 patients. And of those 13 patients, six of them were in employment before they had their surgery. And of those six, now I know the numbers are small, but of those six who were working, three of them have now gone on to half pay following following their surgery because they had an infection. So you can see that that's just a small number, it's just a small sample, but those figures are going to mount up. And the cost to the patient and also to the wider economy is quite considerable. Now, we also have to consider benchmarking. I think currently the main function for surveillance is benchmarking. But if you want to have valid benchmarking, then you've got to compare the same thing. You can't talk about apples and pears. And if you think about surveillance, a problem currently is that there's a spectrum of the quality of the surveillance. So we are currently measuring apples and pears. At my hospital in Leicester, we started a very rigorous surveillance program kind of 2-3 years ago. And because we were so rigorous and we had post-discharge and we follow every single patient and they get contacted on day, we started off with day 10, day 20 and day 30, every single patient. Obviously, we picked up a lot of infections and our rates were 2 to 3 times higher than the national data. And when we presented our data to the Health Protection Agency, who collates the surgical surveillance program for England, when we presented our data to them, we showed up as an outlier. So we were seen to be, you know, a dreadful place to go to because our infection rates were so high. And they sent a team out to us to see what we were doing so badly in our clinical practice. And because of that, we no longer send all of our data to the HPA, to the national program. We only send just the bare minimum what we're asked to. So it's just the mandatory stuff, and we don't give them any post-discharge data because we don't want to be compared unfavorably with other hospitals who do more superficial data collection methods. And it's not just us at Leicester. I travel around the country talking to other people, other hospitals who are wanting to set up really rigorous surveillance programs. And they all say the same thing. They say we're really keen to implement a rigorous surveillance program because we want to find out what's going on in our hospitals. But we're worried about sending our data to the HPA and then being branded as an outlier and having really high infection rates. So benchmarking is an issue. Then if we can come on to the next slide. So what are the limitations with the current system? Well, in England, I've already said, we've got a national, similar to most countries, we have a national surveillance program, which is collated by and organised, coordinated by the Health Protection Agency. So that's great. We've got a national system in place which has got infrastructure and systems and protocols. But it could be improved. Now, it's not just me saying this, okay? Saying that it could be better. If you have a look at the next slide, this is a quote from the House of Commons, the Public Accounts Committee, so it's like a government organisation kind of. And this quote comes from about 2 years ago, and if you have a read there, just before this section, the Public Health Accounts, the Public Accounts Committee, they praised the Department of Health for the developments, the progress and improvements that they've made with MRSA and C. diff, but they said surgical site infections there's still no grip on it, and there's no decent data. So it's not just me saying this. This is a, you know, other people have recognised, well, we've got a problem with our surveillance. And if you have a look at the next slide, then this is what they're referring to. The big problem is that we don't know the size of the problem. Now, we're not as fortunate as this iceberg, because from my schoolgirl history or my physics, I can remember that if you with an iceberg, when you can calculate the mass of the whole iceberg by measuring how much you can actually see. Okay, so if you know what's above the water, then you can do some calculations and work out what's below the water. Now, with surgical site infections, unfortunately, you can't do that at the moment. We don't have enough data to be able to work out calculations. So we can see some infections, and we know that that's not all of them, but we don't know what the ratio is. We don't know how many we're not seeing. And if we move on to the next slide, here I've listed some of the as far as I can see, some of the limitations with the current system. So the first one is interesting, inpatient readmission post-discharge. What's interesting about this is, if you look at the definition of surgical site infection, it says each patient a 30-day follow-up. Now, it doesn't say in the definition we'll look at inpatients and we look at readmissions and we look at post-discharge. It doesn't make those distinctions. So why is it that when the definition says 30-day follow-up, we've changed the focus and we talk about inpatients and readmissions? We find it quite confusing at my hostel here in Leicester, because we don't have this focus. What we do is we contact patients. We started off with day 10, day 20, day 30, but we've now moved and we contact them on day 15 and day 30. So for us, the focus is about the duration, or it's about the time period. So it's day 15 and day 30, and that's when we contact the patient. And if the patient happens to be an inpatient, then we go and visit them on the ward. And if they happen to be at home, then we telephone them. So for us, the geographical location isn't important. It's about the duration of the follow-up. So I think there's a strange, you know, shift that we've moved from 30 days to inpatient readmission and discharge. And with the current system in England, we look at inpatient and readmission data for infections that occur within 30 days of surgery. So we are excluding routinely post-discharge surveillance. And when we did some analysis on our patient data, we found that for our colorectal patients, one-third of our patients, their infections were identified post-discharge. So we're missing out all of those. And for our primary breast surgery, we found that a half of our patients had their SSIs identified in primary care. And ours our work is not the only work that says this. There's many other studies that support these kind of ratios. So it's not small numbers that are being excluded by omitting the post-discharge surveillance. There's quite significant infections out there. And potentially, as the length of stay becomes shorter and shorter because of bed pressures, then it might be that more infections are pushed out into post-discharge surveillance to be collected post-discharge. And I think we make the assumption that some patients with SSIs are readmitted, but that's not necessarily the case. We have come across a lot of patients who are treated with quite serious infections in the community. But I think some more work is needed on this, because what's interesting, just last week I looked at some of our cardiac SSI data, and what was interesting, when I looked at the deep infections for cardiac, they were all detected as inpatients or on readmission. But when I looked at the superficial cardiac infections, they were picked up as inpatients and on post-discharge. So that might be something where we just need to do more work and find out some facts and have a think about collecting deep information, deep SSIs and superficial SSIs, and whether post-discharge is something we want to look at or not. But we need some more work around there. If we move on to the next slide and have a look at the limitations, another limitation is the various methods used. Now, obviously, there are lots of variations in practice in the data collection method, and that leads to different rates of SSIs. So, for example, the staff, the people who actually collect the surveillance data, your ideal would be to have dedicated surveillance staff who are independent. It might be members of the surgical team, or it could be a nurse who's got other responsibilities and is having to collect the data on her in her spare time, as it were. And you can imagine the quality of the data is very different from people who've got dedicated posts and those who are just doing it when they've got some free time. And also the independent or status, the bias of the person involved. I spoke to some orthopaedic surgeons a few months ago, and they said that they didn't present data on superficial infections. They only presented data on deep infections. So I thought that was really interesting that they were doing that. So the person who collects the data affects it. Then also, when the data is collected, is it retrospective when you're relying on documentation? And we all know that documentation in hospital is not brilliant. Or is it prospective, done in real time as the patient's going through the process? And we can imagine that the prospective data is much better quality, and you're going to obviously find more infections that method. How is your data collected? Is it through case note review? Case note review, is it through lab results? Is it through outpatient clinic feedback? Another variation is the definition of infection. Now, although the definitions are quite clear, quite clearly stated, when we started our surveillance program a few years ago, I think we had about 2 meetings with all the people involved where we sat down, and it took us a long time to actually agree on how we interpreted the definition of what an SSI was. The sticking point seemed to be around the bit about clinician diagnosis and about antibiotics. Was a patient who was prescribed antibiotics automatically, did that mean they have an infection? And especially in primary care, when antibiotics are unfortunately antibiotics are given out, the patient hasn't always been had their wound observed. So there's some issues around there. And what's interesting for us is that we're in the middle of sending out a survey to all hospitals in England with lots of different categories, where hopefully we'll identify what the different methods used are, and we'll pick up to the extent of the variations in practice. Because obviously, various practices are going to have an impact on the quality and ultimately the rates of infection. On to the next slide then. The current system says a minimum duration of 3 months for surveillance, so it can be any quarter within the year. Now, if I show you the next slide, this is our data from Leicester for our colorectal patients. It's kind of just, you don't need to worry about reading the figures. This is the data for the past year and a half there. Now, if you look at the rates there, you'll see that this is not a flat line. There are peaks and there are troughs. You can see some peaks notably in May, September, and January. Now, what's interesting is that we have the same pattern also in our cardiac SSIs and also in our orthopedic SSIs. So I think we need to do some more work around this, because our numbers, they're not that small, but they're not huge. We don't have huge databases. So we need to find out, so we can say categorically, is this pattern, is it valid? Are there peaks and troughs, or are SSIs, is the SSI rate a flat line? And if there are peaks and troughs, then what is it that's causing those peaks? And if you think about May, September, and January, holidays spring to mind, where you have staff changeover, working in areas where they don't always work in, or different theatres. And then for another one that stands out is September, when we have the new doctors all swap over. Now, whether this is valid or not, I don't know, but we need to look at this, and then we can say whether or not the 3 month snapshot is representative or not of a hospital's infection rate. So on the next slide then, this is interesting, voluntary versus mandatory. Now, I've got it down as a limitation, because this is what the Public Accounts Committee were complaining about. They were saying that why is not more of the surveillance program mandatory? Now, currently in England, it's mandatory just for orthopaedic surgery, just for one joint procedure, for 3 months, and that's all that hospitals require to do. And if I can tell you about some of the compliance rates, so I've got the latest report here from the HPA, and for the mandatory surgery, for orthopaedic surgery, there are around there's around 180 trusts in England. So there's more hospitals. A trust comprises a small number of hospitals. So there's 180 trusts, and in the orthopaedic mandatory data, 152 hospitals have supplied information. Okay, that's for mandatory. However, for the voluntary, all other procedures are voluntary. For the voluntary ones, the report only gives cumulative numbers since 2006. So that's quite interesting in itself. So they don't give you what happened this year or last year. It's cumulative. So cumulative since 2006, the largest surgical procedure, the largest number of hospitals who have contributed to one to giving data on one procedure is colorectal surgery, and that's 44. Okay, remember that's cumulative since 2006. So the annual figure is obviously much lower than that. So you can see the huge difference between mandatory and voluntary in terms of compliance and sending off data. But right, this does not immediately make me say, therefore, oh, this is terrible that we need to have more mandatory, because my concern is about the quality of the data. I would prefer to have fewer hospitals providing data as long as it's good quality data, and I wouldn't want to have lots of hospitals just ticking the box and sending off cursory, superficial data, which is worse than misleading, because is misleading. When I speak to people about surveillance, they say they don't do surveillance because it's expensive. It's prohibitively expensive. Well, when we looked at doing our surveillance, what we did, we started off with a pilot study, and we had a nurse who was doing our dedicated surveillance data collection. And we looked at the tasks that she did, and we realized that actually you didn't need to be a qualified healthcare professional to collect the data. So what we then did was, when we implemented our program, was we employed grade 2 or grade 3 healthcare assistants who have an annual salary of about £15,000. So it's much cheaper than people had thought. And what you are able to do is, if you do carry out good quality surveillance, then you're able to look at the cost effectiveness, because if you reduce your SSI rates, you're able to see how much money you're spending on the program, but also how much money you're saving. And there's also something to think about is your insurance costs, because you might be able to get cheaper insurance, your hospital insurance, if you're saying that we're doing rigorous surveillance. Right. Well, those are some of the limitations that I think exist with the current surveillance program. So if you have a look onto the next slide, well, I was quite excited when I was contacted and asked if I would talk about my ideal surveillance program. So this is what I would have. So this is me having my cake with a cherry on top. Okay, right? Yeah, I'm indulging myself here. So if we go to the next slide, my first thing on the list here is that, obviously, I think the 30-day follow-up, as it says in the CDC and the HPA definition, and I mean 30 days, and I don't mean things like outpatient clinic, because outpatient clinic is a variable feast. It can be held at any time. So I'm going for a full 30-day follow-up. Now, I've kind of picked 30 days because that's what the definition says, but, perhaps we could go more. This is something where perhaps we need more research. Studies that look at longer follow-ups than 30 days find that you're still picking up infections on day 30 and all the way up to day 45. And it's interesting when you look at the days to diagnosis. If you look at the old studies which were collecting data from inpatients, now based on inpatient data, we used to think that, and still some people still do think, when you ask them how long after surgery do infections present, they talk about 3 to 6 days. Well, that's because that information was based on inpatient data. If you look at the newer studies, we've got the 30-day follow-up, then days to diagnosis is around 11 days. And there's other studies which have got much longer duration of follow-up, around 45 days. And again, they're finding much longer mean days to diagnosis, around 15 days, which is quite interesting. I looked at our cardiac data, and we've been collecting that for about a year and a half, and we've got around 900 patients on that database. And for our cardiac deep infections, we've got a mean days to diagnosis of 10 days. And what's interesting is the superficial, now whether this is statistically significant at 900 patients, I don't know, and with a rate of about 5% SSIs, our superficial infections mean to diagnosis was 11 days, one day longer. So that was kind of interesting. So it makes you think already that there's some differences there, perhaps, between deep and superficials. And if we go on to the next slide, well, obviously, we're going to have everybody doing the exact same method, because if we want to do benchmarking, they've got to do the same method. And obviously, I'd prefer the best method. So I'd be having the patients, all patients contacted by an independent, dedicated surveillance person. But ultimately, if we can't afford that, then I'd like to see that everybody's doing the same thing so we can have genuine benchmarking. And using the same method. Now, what's interesting is that many of the methods involve asking the patients, whether it's through questionnaires or through telephone conversations going through checklists. And there's been some interesting studies that look at patients' interpretation of whether they have SSIs. And they found that patients are very good at saying, identifying their symptoms correctly. So they're able to say whether it's red, swollen, there's fluid leaking from it, whether it's inflamed. But they're then very poor if you say, do you think it's infected? And I say no. So they'll say yes to all the symptoms, but then no to being infected. So some interesting work which might influence how we collect our data. I mentioned earlier that we're doing some interviews with patients. And what was interesting, the patients are being invited personally. The hospital is sending out letters to patients who've had SSIs. So they get a personally addressed letter inviting them to take part in the study to talk about their wound infection. And we've had several patients contact us who said, I don't know why I've been sent this letter because I've never had a wound infection. And these are patients, for example, one of them went back for further surgery and went through three lots of antibiotics. And yet he still didn't actually realize that he'd had a wound infection. So that was really an eye-opener for us to find out, you know, what's going on in the patient's mind. And then I've got something here. No, am I going to talk about that here or later? Yeah, I'll talk about it now. If I can skip, if you can see lower down that list, I've got level one, level two data. What I would like to have is the way that you collect your data is classified as being level one, super duper, or level two, you know, it's okay, it's kind of superficial. Because that's going to help with benchmarking and getting rid of the apples being compared with pears. And if you think about guidelines and recommendations, often at the end of the sentence, the statement after the recommendation, it's got after it, you know, if this is what level, what's the quality of the evidence to support this? You know, is it one to four from the hierarchy of evidence? And this is what I'd like to see for a surveillance program. Hospitals that are doing the top-notch stuff, the really rigorous stuff, they come out with level one data, and their infection rates can't be compared with another hospital who's only doing the superficial data collection and would call them as level two data. So the next thing on the next slide, I've got down the duration. Now, this is something I'm not confident because I'm not sure how you know, remember that slide, the slide I had with the graph going up and down with the peaks and troughs? I don't know if that was genuine, if that's other hospitals are experiencing that as well, if they've been carrying out continuous data. I'd love to know if people have got something like that they could tell me about. So I don't know if 3 months is enough or 6 months or continuous. Ideally, it would be great to have continuous data, but I think the only point in doing continuous data collection is if you're actively doing it for something, so you're actively evaluating an intervention or changes to your clinical practice, because you've got you're expending some resources, so you've got to have a rationale for doing it. And if you're not doing assessing some evaluation or intervention, and you're just doing it for benchmarking purposes, then perhaps you don't need to do continuous surveillance. Let's all just measure with one quarter, but perhaps what's different from the current program is that let's all measure the same quarter, okay? Because if we do have peaks and troughs, let's all measure between April and June. Let's all pick a quarter, and that's the one that we'll compare ourselves with. Then on the next slide is the mandatory versus voluntary, and I've already spoken about this, and I don't know the answer to this. I've got to say, my choice is that I would prefer to have meaningful quality data. So I'd rather have quality than quantity. And if So if the only way of getting quality data is just making it voluntarily, then I'd prefer to do that. If it has to be mandatory, then I'd prefer that everybody's using the same method, whether it's level one method or level two method, so that we can have benchmarking. And it might be that if we do have voluntary, but it's high quality data, then that might be that more hospitals are happy to comply with that, because then we can show that there's some benefits arising from good quality surveillance and people might want to become involved with that program. So if we move to the next slide, and then we're skipping level one and level two data because I've already talked about that, and then move on to the next one. And then we come to deep and superficial. Now, this is a debate which is just beginning to emerge, and I do apologize. When I say deep, I mean deep and organ space. It's too long to say. So deep and superficial. Currently, we measure everything together. We present our data together, all the superficial, deep organ space. We lump it all together. But I'm querying here, and I'm saying whether I'm being devil's advocate, I'm not quite sure. Is it necessary to collect data on superficial SSIs? I don't know how many years ago, there are several papers, but they're very old papers. And what the old papers said was that a superficial infection could progress to become a deep infection. You know, it could work its way down through the layers. Now, I don't know if that still holds. The problem is, somebody once asked me, does the data that we have at Leicester, can we look at that? Do the superficial infections that we have, do they progress onto deep infections? And the answer is no, but all our superficial infections then get put on antibiotics, et cetera, et cetera. So they don't have the opportunity to progress to deep infections, so we don't know. And the problem is we would never get ethics approval to have a study to investigate whether that's possible or not. So we're not sure about that. That state of the argument. If you looked at it with a microscope, then obviously their potential is for, you know, because of the size of them, you know, you've got sutures there. There's sort of tracks that potentially bacteria from the top layer could work their way down. So the potential is there, but we don't know how often that happens. Then you've also got to say, well, superficial infections, how much do they cost? I mean, you know, what's different about superficial infections? Whenever we've done data analysis looking at cost, unfortunately, and this is our fault, we've just lumped our superficial and our deep infections together, and that's our fault. We should have split them up before and had a look about what the difference was. I did look at some of our data recently for length of stay, because length of stay is the biggest, it's the most expensive cost for treating surgical site infections. And I looked at our cardiac database and I looked at our colorectal database. And what was interesting was our superficial infections for both of those types of procedures, our superficial infections had the same length of stay as our patients who did not have any infections. So the biggest cost, whereas the patients who had deep infections had, it was length of stay was the big difference for them. So it might be that the costs are a lot lower with surgical site infections. So it might, but is it that the costs are so low that it's almost not worth presenting data on that? And then also the inconvenience to the patient from a surgical site infection, as we're learning from doing our interviews with the patients, the inconvenience from the surgical site infection is very different from the inconvenience from the caused by the deep infections. There is still some inconvenience with the superficial, but it's not on the same. It's not the same scale as the deep infections. So something to think about is whether should, unlike those orthopedics, the orthopods said, should we just collect deep data on deep infections, and should we ignore the superficial ones? So that's something for us to have a think about. And then if we move on to the next slide and look at compliance data. Now, we currently collect surveillance data on risk factors, so the duration of the surgery, body mass index, ASA, but we don't routinely collect data on compliance. But we need to collect data on compliance, because if you want to look and see what the problems are with your clinical practice, where are the flaws, where are the faults, where are we falling down, you need to have compliance data so you can you can't, there's no point just having an SSI rate, because you can say, well, yeah, that's high, but well, where are we falling down in our practice? You need to have compliance data in as well, and that's something that I would definitely include within a surveillance program. I've been surprised recently when I've looked at some studies which have looked at the effectiveness of interventions or the effectiveness of care bundles. And they've commented and said whether the intervention or the care bundle was effective or whether it was not effective. And it's been really interesting, especially once we've said this is not effective. But they haven't actually measured the compliance with the intervention. I think this is really strange indeed. How can they be sure that the intervention was actually implemented? Compliance is a massive, huge, complex issue. We implemented at Leicester, we started last summer looking at a care bundle and the compliance with the care bundle. And we found, we implemented some new things. And we found that some of these things, it took about 4 months of, going to the wards every day, promoting products. It took about 4 months before practice was changed and new interventions were implemented. So compliance is actually very difficult. And what we realise is that we don't just rely on documented data, which is why retrospective SSI surveillance is always a bit worrying. For example, we've been measuring compliance for years for our hospital as part of our surveillance programme. And a lot of it, for example, was, at bear huggers, the warming devices you use in the operating theatre. Well, we rely on documentation for that. So we score very well on that. We routinely have 100% compliance. All patients for specific procedures have the bear hugger applied in theatre. Now, as part of our care bundle compliance study, which we had earlier, at the end of last year, we employed a person who went round and didn't just look at what it said on the tick boxes on the documentation, but actually went into the theatres and had a look and to see what they were doing. And what was interesting, it wasn't in every case, but she did find that when she walked into the theatre, yes, the person had a bear hugger on top, but the bear hugger wasn't always switched on. Or the bear hugger was on top. Now, bear huggers work by convection, so like circulating air. So the bear hugger was on top of the patient, but it was also on top of the patient's gown. So they're not effective. So compliance, some really good compliance data is I think, crucial to have in a surveillance program. But not just ticking the box stuff. If you can do some snapshot stuff where people go in and do some really deep having a look at what's going on. Okay, the next slide, feedback. I am really excited about feedback. This is one of the things I think if anybody can do that, if you want to do one thing, like do feedback. Now, there's some work that's already been done on feedback, and there's a European study, I can't remember, 2006 maybe, I think it came out. And just from having rapid surveillance feedback, they dropped their infection rate from 5% to 2%. Now, those rates are quite low, which is a bit almost implausibly low, I'm tempted to say. But still, you can see they managed to drop their rate by about whatever that is, a third or something. And I think that good rapid surveillance should be integral to surveillance rapid feedback should be integral to surveillance. And I don't mean any old feedback. I mean rapid, and I mean, monthly. And that's going to all staff, so not just consultant surgeons, all staff who are involved in the patient journey from, admission right through to post-discharge, because it's everyone's responsibility. At UHL, when we started our care bundle at the summer, we changed our surveillance, our feedback program. What we previously did was we had a report and it went out quarterly, and it kind of went to like the senior people within the hospital, and then it was cascaded through meetings. Well, that was the theory was that it was cascaded through meetings and through emails. But those of you who work in hospitals know the process and how frequently people read their emails and all sorts of things. So what we did with our care bundle was we had a single sheet, okay, so nice and easy to read, single sheet with just the facts, and it went to everyone. And we did all the top-down approaches like the meetings and the emails, but we also stuck them on coffee room doors and we stuck them on scrub sinks, and those came out every month so everyone could see what was happening. And this is where we realised that feedback is actually very complex. And you don't just feedback data, you have to target it. You've got to get it right. Now, when we started, we have, in our trust, we have three hospitals, and we do colorectal. So, for example, I'll give you this example of the colorectal feedback. We have two hospitals that do colorectal surgery. And we started off with our single sheet of paper, and we put it all over the place. And the staff said, yes, but those infections, and we give them the SSI rate, just a lump sum, just a lump figure, one figure, for that previous month. And they said, yes, but those infections all happened at the general, not our hospital. And then when we went to the Royal, they said, but all those infections will have happened at the general. So no one took responsibility. So the following month, we had to separate out our data. So we had infections at the general and infections at the Royal. And we still had it both on the one sheet so that each hospital could see how the other one was doing, because that was actually quite helpful. So that we did that the next month. And then we had a problem because the staff said, yes, but those are probably superficial infections and they don't really matter, not deep infections. So the next month we had to separate it by hospital, but also by superficial infections and then by deep infections. And subsequent to that, they said, well, you know, antibiotic prophylaxis, those were probably emergency patients, not electives. So then we had to split it out by emergency and elective. And then things began to get interesting because it was about taking responsibility. And when we just fed back infection rates, well, everyone really contributes to the infection rate, the patient themselves, the surgical team, the anaesthetic staff, the ward staff. So what we then did, we increased the amount of compliance data. And when we got into compliance data, it was much more attributable to specific individuals. So, for example, it was at the level of the ward when we were able to say, this is the percentage of patients who did or did not get their pre-op washing before they came to theatre. This is the patients who are in this theatre who didn't get the proper surgical skin prep. And you could see that it's much more responsibility was much more easy to work out. And it got to the stage where, for example, with the antibiotics, where they're meant to be given, we had the compliance for whether they were given on the 1 hour up to surgery, where people would say, name names. Who are the people who are not giving the antibiotics at the right time? Where is it being delayed? So it was about our feedback, getting it targeted and appropriate without a blame culture. We definitely weren't interested, you know, in doing that. But it had to be really targeted. And it wasn't until we got our rapid feedback right until changes started happening and people saying, oh, gosh, you know, I've not done that. I need to, you know, that's me that's at fault there. I need to change that. And people taking responsibility. So if we can move on to the last section, well, you know, why? Okay, I've told you all about, I would love to have a surveillance program which is really rigorous and does all these super duper things. But why bother? Well, the first slide here, rapid surveillance feedback. If we've got all that data, then we can feedback really good information to our staff, and that's what leads to changes. And then the next slide, number 24 there. Well, if we've got detailed surveillance data and we've got detailed compliance data, we can identify areas of weak practice, we can target those, and that's where we can start improving and reducing our SSI rates. And if you move to the next slide, the trusts prepared to share data. We did a pilot study, I think I'm sure I've mentioned it, about 3 or 4 years ago, and with really rigorous surveillance, dedicated staff, post-discharge follow-up. And we were really worried when we were collecting this data that we wouldn't be allowed to publish because our rates were so high, and we thought the hospital will not want us to share this with anyone. And I've also spoken earlier about meeting colleagues across the country who didn't want to share their rigorous data, especially with the national program, because they would look bad. But if everyone is doing rigorous surveillance data, or you're able to say this is level one data or it's level two data, then people will be happier to share because they're not being compared unfairly with people who are doing less rigorous data collection, and they're going to stop holding back. And then on to the next slide. The benefits of surveillance is that we'll identify real SSI rates. Now, I don't know why I've put this, fourth on the list. I should have probably had this first. If we do rigorous surveillance, then we're going to find out the true, a much more realistic extent of the scale of surgical site infections. And if we find out how many of them, then we're going to increase their importance and we'll increase their profile. And if we increase their importance and their profile, then hopefully compliance with best practice will improve because people will say, oh, my word, these rates are sky high. I can't just sail along as I've been doing before. There's a problem here. And also, give more accurate costs of the infection, then we're going to be able to come out with better, more accurate costs of the burden of treating these infections. And again, that's going to be another driver for change. And then to the next slide, another benefit, benchmarking, commissioning, patient choice. If we have proper, valid benchmarking, then that could be used for commissioning and also by patients when they're choosing which hospital to have their surgery. We have, in England, we have something called sequin targets, and those are quality targets which are agreed with the commissioners, so the people who purchase surgical procedures from the hospital. And so we agree jointly on quality measure targets, and if the hospital, if we fail to meet those, then there are financial penalties associated with that. And since we started our SSI surveillance program a few years ago, we now have sequin targets around our surveillance, around our SSI rates. Now, what's interesting is that when we started the surveillance and our sequin targets, when we started, we almost picked numbers out of the air. So let's say that our infection rate was 20%. So the commissioning organization said, okay, we want you to bring that down by 5%, down to 15%. And if you don't do that, then we'll financially penalize you however many hundreds of thousands of pounds. So we started off by looking at infection rates and bringing them down. But the problem there was that we were almost picking numbers out of the air. So they were saying, well, let's reduce by 2%, reduce by 5%. And they were kind of guessing at these numbers. And the difficulty with that is we, as the hospital, we didn't really have a lot of control over that. Because if you think about it, a lot of the patients who come through your door, they're smokers, they've got high body mass index, they didn't use that pre-op washing stuff that they were given. So you can't be... you can't have full control over reducing your infection rates. So what we've moved to quite successfully was looking at compliance, okay? So what we do for our sequin targets is we're able to say it's 100%. With 100% of our patients got the antibiotics 60 minutes before surgery, 100% of the patients had the warming blanket put on, 100% had the pre-op warming blanket put on, 100% had, oh, I don't know, what else did they get? Clippers rather than shaver razors, that sort of thing. So we've got a list. So what's great about our rigorous surveillance, which includes compliance data, is that we've got control of them. We've got much more control with them adhering to compliance rather than adhering to or agreeing to reduce SSI rates, and that's much better for us. So that's another benefit. And then last of all, if we move on to the last slide. So everything's gone a bit quiet. Oh, no. Okay. If we move on to the last slide then, here, this is a really interesting one, probably perhaps more for the research-minded amongst you. But if we've got decent data, let's say you've got decent continuous data, you can actually measure the effectiveness of new interventions or changes to clinical practice. And I think that's fantastic. I remember speaking to a surgeon a while ago, and he wanted to spend a lot of money on buying some new gowns, and he wanted to be able to justify spending the money. And he was really struggling because he didn't have any decent baseline data. But if you've got really rigorous surveillance data, then you can do, when you want to implement something new, you're able to justify and prove that it's effective if you've got decent data there. What you can also do is you can team up, if your sample size is not big enough in your hospital, then if other hospitals are also doing decent rigorous surveillance, then it's much easier for you to team up with other hospitals to generate larger sample sizes. So I hope I've shown you that there is a value in implementing rigorous surveillance. And if there are some people out there and you already do rigorous surveillance, then please get in touch, because I think it'd be brilliant to get a network of hospitals who already conduct really good surveillance and share some ideas and some discussion. That would be brilliant. So thank you very much for listening to me for the past, 45 minutes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judith. That was really interesting, and I'm certainly up for being part of your network as a rookie or large-scale surgical site infection surveillance coordinator. There you go. Judith, could you just tell us the definition of surveillance that you use? Is it the same one that the Health Protection Agency uses based on the CDC work?
Yes.
It is.
Yes, it is. It's the HPA one, which is slightly different from the CDC one.
Yeah.
And the difference is around the diagnosis by the clinician. I think the CDC one says it's okay to have clinician diagnosis, whereas the HPA one says it's clinician diagnosis plus the signs and symptoms. And for us, what was interesting was we were able to change our rate of infection. I think we were able to reduce it by about 2% overnight just by slightly tweaking how we interpreted the definition. Because we did post-discharge surveillance, if a patient was prescribed antibiotics in primary care by the GP or the district nurse, then I think we had started off by taking that as meaning that they had an infection. But what we now do is if a patient is prescribed antibiotics in primary care, we contact the person who gave them who prescribed the antibiotics, and we say, did you actually observe the wound? And it's unfortunate to hear that several primary care professionals are prescribing antibiotics without actually having observed the wound. So then they didn't meet the definition of having their wound observed and there being the signs and symptoms. So we excluded those patients, and that brought our infection rate down by about 2%.
So interesting, isn't it? The more you delve, the more you find or don't find.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Judith. That's a really useful session. So with that, we'll close. If there are any questions for Judith at all, then please send them by email to info@webertraining.com directly to Judith. As she said, she's happy to be contacted by enthusiastic others. So thanks again, Judith, and with that we'll close. Thank you.
Thank you very much.